Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I sort of feel like break has already started, so I'm going to try to, I'll try to come back here. We're ending term really late this year, and it just feels a little bit funny. And happy solstice. I love this image that seeds germinate in the dark. And we need all this. Everybody complains about the dark, but we need all this dark to germinate. And now the light will come back and we can grow. So today I'm talking about one of the many lists and formulas that we have. We have an endless set of formulas in Buddhism, and we don't talk very much about one called the social laws. You might encounter it today as the four methods of guidance or the four ways of leading sentient beings into enlightenment. But it's very old. It's in the Pali Canon. Specifically for you Pali Canon nerds, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya in the Book of Fours. And there it is. I'm going to read you a bunch of different translations. The four means of gathering people to the Dharma, the four bases of a supportive relationship, four means of conversion, four means of assembling disciples, four means of gathering beings, four means of positively influencing others. And in Zen today, it's almost entirely, we know this through a fascicle of Dogen called Bodhisattva Shishoho, the Bodhisattva's Methods for Social Relations, or Social Relationship. So it's the emphasis here, you can tell, is really on social. So the four means of leading sentient beings to enlightenment are going to be pretty familiar mostly. Giving, which we know from the paramitas. Giving is the first of the paramitas, generosity. Kind speech, part of the Eightfold Path. Beneficial action or helping others. And then what I learned to call identity action, which is what I'm going to talk about today. These are all considered upaya, skillful means, or methods for skillfully bringing people to the Dharma. They are also each virtues in themselves, in and of themselves. So, like the precepts, the four social laws are considered the natural characteristics of a Buddha. Spontaneous and natural, completely intrinsic to anybody who deeply understands emptiness and understands the nature of reality. So I want to talk particularly about identity action because it's the one people mostly don't talk about because it's tricky, it's difficult, it's subtle. And that's really reflected in how no two translators even come close to each other in how they translate this term. The Sanskrit word for you Sanskrit nerds is artacharya. And I would say giving kind speech and beneficial or helpful action are almost always translated exactly the same way. It's only this last one that gets translated so differently. Identity of purpose. Cooperation. Identification of self with others. Non-difference. Mutual service, non-opposition, consistency between words and deeds, making friends, not excluding, being at one with, keeping company with, an adaptation of oneself with others, impartiality. That is a really broad set of ideals, all from this one word. In Japanese, the word is doji, which means do is a long o, do is same, and ji is thing or matter or task. So same thing, or identity of task, or identity of action. Dogen says cooperation means not differing. Not differing from self, not differing from others, When we understand cooperation, self and other are one. So to Dogen, this G, and to a lot of people who translate this word, the G, thing, matter, or task, it really means manner, posture, how you hold yourself, its dignity, its presentation, something really concrete and functional and in the relative world. It's not flighty, it's not metaphysical, it's not esoteric. So we really look at this identity action, something that's awake and functioning and present. You can't just think or feel that you get another person. You have to act from that place. So it's not just behavior. It's thoughts, it's judgments, it's ideas. And identity action is action that proceeds from this point of identification. We could have separation action. We mostly have separation action, which is proceeding from the point of thinking we're separate. Proceeding from a position of difference. And that's our default human delusion a lot of the time, that we are separate from each other. So this is pushing directly back at that delusion. When we read commentaries about bodhisattva behavior, it's often described as how you would behave toward a baby. Because identification with babies is really easy for most people. It's natural, it's immediate, very ordinary response that comes from a deeply instinctive place. And nothing special. It's something almost all of us understand, the silly, easy way we are with babies. And when you hear a baby cry, almost all of us have this immediate way of turning toward that baby. So that's the practice and vow of the bodhisattva, to treat everything with such immediate, instinctive caring, and to act from that place. Now, our good little devil, Shantideva, discusses the four ways in detail. He spends a lot of time on each of them, and he's really good at giving clear and kind of devastatingly simple methods for how to recognize our delusions and how to practice these virtues. So the first one, the fundamental one, to develop identification with others, you look at your own body. Another being is related to me the way my hand is related to me, the way my foot is related to my hand. I should be as concerned about other beings as I am about my foot, as I am about my hand. When my foot hurts, I want it to stop. And if I ignore it, it doesn't go away. So Shantideva reminds us at the beginning, the body is a single entity, all beings are a single entity. Easier said than done, right? Everybody is I from one point of view and other from every other point of view. It's easy to forget that I am other to all of you because I am the center of this universe. And I know that. And I think everyone should know that, right? But each of us is other to all the rest. It's one of the key aspects of the Four Noble Truths is, can we apply this to everything? Can we see what we mean when we say all things are marked by dukkha? All things, we tend to leave a lot out of these formulas. All things I like, all things I recognize, all beings that are close to me, those I understand, but the ones I don't like, the ones I'm angry with, they're out. The Noble Truths are telling us that even the most foreign or strange or opaque or distressing being in your life is exactly like you. Exactly. Now, Shantideva, he's very clever. How many of you have read Shantideva? clever guy. He points out that we're trying to create happiness for the future self all the time. But that self is also other. It's just as other as the people right next to us. It's not here. In some ways, our future self is entirely non-existent. And we try to protect that self, and we try to protect our past self, or we blame or defend our past selves all the time, and they're totally non-existent. We put all this energy into these non-existent beings. And if we care so much about those invisible beings, Shanti Deva says, why is it so hard to care for the flesh and blood people right in front of us? Why is that so hard? One reason it's hard is that when we identify with others, we will see and feel their suffering. Why would we want to open ourselves to the pain of other people? When we open ourselves at all, we open ourselves to pain. We respond quickly to babies who are crying. We find it easier to feel their pain somehow. And at times we can respond to the pain of strangers in a way that we recognize as a similar to our pain. But with people that we dislike, are angry with, don't understand, we don't even recognize that they are suffering. In his chapter on the four social laws, Dogen quotes a book called the Guanzi, a very old Chinese book. This is from Okamura's translation. The ocean does not refuse water. Therefore, it is able to achieve vastness. Mountains do not refuse earth. Therefore, they are able to become tall. Wise rulers do not weary of people. Therefore, they form a large nation. That the ocean does not refuse water is identity action. We should also know that the virtue of water does not refuse the ocean. This is why water is able to form an ocean and earth is able to form mountains. We should know in ourselves that because the ocean does not refuse to be the ocean, it can be the ocean and achieve greatness. Because mountains do not refuse to be the mountains, they can be mountains and reach great height. There's another translation that says, this is the way that water is friends with the sea and soil is friends with mountains. I just love water is friends with the sea. So notice that it's not just that the ocean doesn't reject water, the vastness does not reject the particular, but that water doesn't reject the ocean. The particular does not reject the vast. That's an important part. That's what cooperation really is. It goes both ways. It's the ocean not rejecting the ocean. The ocean being willing to be an ocean. In Dogen's words, cooperation means not differing. It is not differing from self, not differing from others. So Shanti Deva gives us these very basic exercises. They sound so simple, but they're painful to actually do. He says, and remember, this is coming from a time of great social strata, very, very strict social classes. We have a little less of that here, but enough to go around. Start by identifying with someone that you see is worse off or lower in rank than you. You try to get into that mindset in order to feel that they envy you. What is it like for you to be the object of envy? Then you identify with an equal and you try to feel rivalry, jockeying for position. And then you identify with somebody better off or higher than you and you feel their pride, their superiority over you. And what part of what you're doing, besides allowing yourself to feel these emotions, is you can feel what it's like to see yourself as the other, to be the object of envy, to be the object of condescension. We can also practice this identity action with ourselves as well by looking at our past selves. A lot of us struggle with self-hatred, with shame about our past selves, with regret for things that have happened. And all that does is take us further away from our chance to experience intimacy with the world and with each other. Shame and regret leave us bereft and lonely. But we find it really hard to give these emotions up. So we can work with identity action here by taking the position of that past self. Not me. My young woman, my child is not me. But I can try to take that position and understand her motivation, try to come into sympathy with her choices, with her actions. What motivated her? What drove her? Why did those seem like the right choices? You just have to be careful not to over-identify and to always remember that a past self is not you any more than any other self is you. You take that view and you try to understand them and not get lost. Come back to this moment. One reason I think identity action is tricky is that all of us have a tension between really wanting to be seen clearly as we are and not wanting to be seen at all. We have this very confused tension. So part of what happens when we practice identity action is we go directly into that tension. We stop differing from ourselves. We become the ocean, not rejecting the ocean. We become ourselves. We allow ourselves to be seen by identifying entirely with ourselves. So water is friends with the sea. It's such a striking image. And then Shantideva throws this curveball about wise rulers and their subjects. An emperor makes friends with his people. An emperor doesn't differ from his people. It's a very odd comparison, but maybe not if you lived under an emperor. They had the power of oceans. They had the power over everybody's lives. So a wise ruler could identify with those people. We have this great example of identity action, which is the Buddha's life. He, she, it was a being of deep wisdom who was willing again and again and countless again and again to be born, to work at perfecting, to be born a suffering being, to struggle until finally he was born a human being in a life in which he could awaken fully. And after that awakening, he chose to stay in an imperfect suffering human body because of this complete identification with the suffering of all beings. And at that moment, he said, I was, am, and will be enlightened with all beings. If he steps out of that identification, if he steps out of the suffering of others, he can't do that. So part of the point, in Dogen's words, is it doesn't mean there is no reward or punishment. This is what he adds. It doesn't mean there is no reward or punishment. Sometimes people hear talks like this about identifying with others, and they think it means some sort of passive acceptance of wrongness. There's nothing passive in Buddhism anywhere. It doesn't mean simply accepting misbehavior or evil behavior. It doesn't mean allowing mistreatment, although we often defend ourselves much more than we need to. We tend to be far more defensive than we need to be, but Identity action means joining with that other person's point of view so totally that you understand the motive, you understand the meaning of their actions. What appears to be evil or at least misbehavior may be coming from a deep misunderstanding. It may be coming from deep fear. It may be a completely deluded point of view. But you have to understand it in order to have an effect on it. Otherwise, it's just this. If we really want to change other people and their behavior in the world, we have to inhabit them. You have to take that other point of view in order to act wisely. At the very end of his commentary, Dogen says, "We should face all things only with gentle faces, but we should face them." We act from there. We don't turn away from reality. Now, I know it's easier to see, at least it's for me, it's a lot easier to see a Buddha in the blade of grass than my next door neighbor. But I'm trying. When we truly see into another person's inner life, any other person's inner life, we feel love for that person. I spent a lot of years trying to be this really good Zen student and only be seen by my teacher as a really good Zen student and hide all that crap inside, only to realize eventually that I was like stark naked in plain sight and that I wasn't actually being rejected like I feared. When you see deeply into another person, I think love is the only reaction because you see into their pain. You see into their suffering. My favorite contemporary writer is Dainen Katagiri. Most of you know that because I quote him a lot. He says this form of identity action functions in the vastness of experience that we know from trees and stones. He calls this the huge I, that the I self, that is extending into the present, the past, and the future, to heaven and hell in all directions. That's what we see from trees and stones. So sometimes I used to just dread the rain. I used to hide from the rain like I would hide from everybody else. And now I like to go out in the rain. And look at trees, because what a lesson. They are just living true non-resistance. Making friends, not excluding, being at one with, keeping company with the rain. And the rain is making friends with the trees. That's real identity action. Can I stand in the rain the way a tree does? Can I stand with you the way a tree stands in the rain? No judgment, no bias, no wishing, no pride or rivalry or envy, just cooperating. So that's how the water enters the ocean. No matter how trivial or small, all things enter vastness. Even really ordinary people like us. Because to be totally ordinary is to really live your Buddha nature. Buddha is a totally ordinary being. It just means to be born, to grow, to work, to get sick, to get hurt, to feel love, to need things, to make mistakes, to die. And the greatest of the Buddha's virtues might be this totality, this total identification, totally himself, totally identified with you, totally human. That's my talk.
If you would like to make a question or a comment, raise your hand and I will pass the microphone to you. Please angle the microphone towards your mouth and speak into it so that everyone can actually hear you, and say your name before posing your question. If you are on Zoom, please type your name into the chats or ask to be unmuted, and our co-host, Kaylin, will do so. And I think that's all to say there. And the first person I saw was you.
This is Jen. Thanks for the talk. What came to my mind was Brené Brown. She talks about having a strong back and a soft front as you approach the world, and I like that. That resonated with that idea of gentle face. And also she talks about the difference between sympathy and empathy, and that when you have sympathy, you're like kind of looking down on, there's a sense of condescension of like, oh man, I'm sorry you're having a hard time. But empathy is when you really touch that part of yourself that knows that suffering and are in that suffering with another person, and how important that is for connection and belonging amongst people. And the other thing it touched on was Kakamyo said in a talk like a few months ago that like something like we're all connected, and the nature of that connection is benevolence, almost as if it's just it's something there to discover, not mm-hmm. necessarily something we do. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah, I think following on that, we don't try to take others' suffering on ourselves or take it away from other people. We might act to relieve the conditions that are causing suffering, but we don't rescue each other. That's part of the cooperation, is to not think you've got the solution or the cure for other people's suffering.
Hi, this is Genko. I want to follow up a little bit on this empathy thing, because I remember from years past, I did a workshop as a part of what I was working with about empathy and some other things. But one of the things they said about empathy is that it allows you to enter somebody's world, and that you need to be able to step back out of that world. So that gets into a little bit of the trickiness that you're talking about identifying with, and also not losing yourself in a way. So maybe you could expand on that just a little bit.
Well, yeah, and I think that's part of what I mean about our past selves. We tend to get completely identified with and lost in our past selves. That's where we do it the most. But I think we have to be careful with words like empathy, sympathy, and pity, because that's one of those sets of words that have such cultural meaning and different resonance for different people. What we want to do is be able to feel another person's point of view so that we can understand their experience. It's not to change their point of view necessarily or even to change their experience, but to know them. And right now, and there's a lot of people in public life that many of us feel really rejecting of. And it's a good place to start. They're part of the ocean too, so how do we do that? How do we enter into a point of view that is very, very different from ours?
The other thing that I touched on when you were talking was this business of the past selves. At one point, I know I was really struggling with some of that, and I found myself looking at my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old and my 10-year-old, very specific persons, a couple of them I even gave names to. And at one point, I just realized, but they're all right here. And I said, let's just hold hands and realize we're just doing this together, and it's going to be okay. So I actually have this sensation of holding hands with them, kind of hugging with them. So that was an interesting kind of way of kind of reconciling with all those past selves mm-hmm. that were really problematical in a lot of ways.
Right. But you didn't get lost in them.
No, it was because we're here right now. So we're okay right now. We don't have to just get stuck back there.
Yeah.
This is Gyoshi. So I was traveling recently abroad in Italy and found myself doing something that felt very powerful. And that was when somebody did something that affected me, I reflected it to them. And this was, you know, somebody did something that was wonderful for me. And it may have seemed small to them, but I pointed it out to them. And that made for some moments of really deep connection. And it felt, you know, almost like an electricity between the two of us. And this happened over and over again. And I'm thinking that's somewhere in there, in what you're,
Yeah, and it reminds me of something that Trungpa said. It's part of the mottos for Vajrayana practice. They have all these slogans. And he says, if somebody pokes you or punches you in the face, you should say, thank you for noticing me.
Yeah.
And, you know, easier said than done. But his point is that everything is a teacher. Everything is the Buddha. Everything we encounter is reflecting our Buddha nature to us. And how we respond to that is a sign of how in touch we are with that Buddha nature, which identifies with all beings. Yeah. We'll come back to you.
I'm Guy. I was thinking about why I like Hesse's Siddhartha, because he completely like inverts the story about, you know, Prince Gautama, the Buddha. The Siddhartha in that character goes the other direction. So he starts out as this incredibly devout, you know, person who's always meditating, and then he figures out that actually he has to go into the city and become like a rich merchant in order to really relate to the Kindermenschen, he calls them, these child people, you know, these kind of people who are mesmerized by worldly things. In order to really fully relate to them, he has to become and join them and kind of, you know, go the other direction, go back into the palace, you know. And there's there's an irony to that, but there's like it's kind of a truth to that, maybe.
Right.
In order to not look down on them, you know, he calls them Kindermenschen, childlike people, right. Which is kind of contemptible, an attitude of contempt. But you know, he has to get beyond that. So
sitting and developing wisdom by staring at the wall for decades doesn't do anybody much good. It's about taking samadhi and prajna together. It's about having wisdom affect your action that makes the difference. So we say, you know, it's easy to be enlightened in a cave. You've probably heard that. It's what we call karma relationship is one of the phrases that we use for it. It's only when your wisdom encounters another human being that it gets activated and you get to really see your karma. When you're in a cave, you can avoid every trigger. But as soon as you're out in the world, then this all gets tested deeply. Yeah.
Thank you, Jiko, for your talk. I'm Roka. Punched in the face, I feel like I've been some in the last few months. This situation, my mom passing away, my brother executor of my mom's estate, and my brother undermining me, and publicly undermining me, punching me. It feels like on purpose, pointing out my shortcomings. And I just feel targeted, and another sibling does too. It's very uncomfortable. And I've really struggled to find the tenderness there. I've wanted to connect with my brother at times and be closer. He's my only brother, and then this happened. So I'm struggling with it.
Right. Well, and be kind to yourself as well. We don't develop characteristics like this overnight, you know. The Buddha took countless lives, so we get to take a few months, all right? Be you can spend some time thinking about what his motivation might be, what his point of view might be, and then remember Dogen says it doesn't mean there is no reward or punishment. You can then act relatively in the world and gradually work your way in. And there are people that will always be opaque to us, that we may never be able to understand, that we may never be able to identify with, but it's worth trying. It's just worth the effort.
Thank you.
Eiko's had his hand up.
Who's that?
The man in the beret.
This is Eiko. So what I, an important thing that I heard was your sort of distillation down to sort of three ranks, the one where one is condescended to, the one where one is in sort of an equal relationship, and then, you know, the people that, you know, we look down upon or in some way are inferior. And I feel like I've had all those experiences, you know, in the past 7 days, and from a very intense debate, you know, an aggravated debate with an equal, to attending a holiday party where I felt out of place, to, you know, driving in this morning and passing people living outside. And I just sort of was thinking about how, you know, seeing a potential for one to be a prompt for to think about the other. And the easy one, of course, is, at least for me, you know, the people living outside. And if one could think about that in those other, you know, positions, you know, maybe that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I take those positions every day. Those reactions can arise for me every day. One of the practices I've done in the last couple of years is when I find myself irritated in a setting, like at a store, these days the post office or the bank or whatever, irritated with somebody or in traffic, that's another good one, I try to ask myself, would I like to trade places with this person? Would I rather be the postal clerk than the person in line at the post office? Would I rather be this a person addicted to fentanyl living on the corner and screaming at me, or would I rather be me? And to just realize how easy it is for us to just negate another person, to just dismiss another person instead of noticing their experience, their struggle. And we project so much on other people too. Part of this is to actually understand what their real experience is, not what we think their experience is. Yeah. About two or three more at the most.
This is Christina. And one thing that struck me of your talk, what you said about if you open yourself at all, you're opening up to pain. And I've found that to be very true. Not only pain, like there's joy and other things happening also, but I have this experience of like opening and all that coming in, and then it's like, ding, I better close that down to go. It seems skillful in a way to like close that down, mm-hmm. to work and do the things of life, but like, I just wonder, is that skillful, or like maybe it's not skillful to have as much closing down as I have?
No, I think that is a skill we develop, how far and how fast to protect ourselves, mm-hmm. when to protect ourselves, when to shut down. It would be crazy to just stay open to everybody's suffering.
Okay.
All the time. You know, and if you ever think about bodhicitta, anybody who's ever done a retreat, remember how you felt on the last day as you were going home after a 7-day retreat? The image I always use is that I'm trying to raise an orchid on a crowded sidewalk, like trying to protect, and that's my heart. Your heart becomes very tender, very open, very, just very receptive after a lot of meditation. And then you go out into the world and your heart gets beaten up. So it's a learning process of how far and how fast and when to do that. And, you know, in your profession, in our profession, in healthcare, we have to really be very careful about identification with others. I saw Daye. Maybe we'll call it at that point. Yeah, you're the swan song. Better be good.
It all ends here with you.
Thank you very much. So I'm Die Guy. You said the water rejects the ocean. That happens.
Yeah.
Right? And that's an important teaching. And so what I was going to ask you for the assembly, if you would just say a little bit more about that and the trouble that can cause.
So what I'm really saying is the particular, the individual, is rejecting oneness, the vastness. Geez, we do that more than almost anything. That's like our basic human default position, is to reject interbeing and interrelationship. And we have to for a while. I mean, this practice is for people with strong personalities and good boundaries and a healthy sense of self. If you come in with no boundaries, you're going to get really lost in this practice. So we come in solid individuals, and then we learn to soften that. But a lot of us then have an experience where we touch vastness or we touch oneness with something, and it's so scary. That means that self is going to disappear. What happens to this self when I touch oneness? That little drop of water seems to go away in the ocean. Do I really want to go away? And that's I think, the limit of the metaphor, because the ocean is made of many drops of water. And the only way to discover the safety of being in the ocean is to do it. Everybody can tell you that it's okay to experience oneness, but you have to get there.
And to notice yourself when you're keeping it at bay.
Yeah, when you're deliberately staying separated. That goes to part of what Christina was saying, is at what point is it too much? At what point do I need to let myself feel that connection and that? Okay.